From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Ancient Wisdom. Here's what's happening. Tragedy at Ohio State University today. An 18-year-old Somali student was behind an attack involving a car and butcher knife attack on the campus of Ohio State University that left 11 people injured. After the attacker, identified by authorities as a first-year student, Abdul Razak Ali Artan, plowed his vehicle into the crowd. He then got out of the car and began attacking people with a butcher knife before he was shot and killed by a campus police officer. Two law enforcement sources said that Arlint came into the United States as a Somali refugee and was granted status as a legal permanent resident. Thousands filing through the memorial honoring Fidel Castro in Cuba. In Havana, the thousands were piling through a memorial in Havana's Plaza of the Revolution. He died this weekend at the age of 90 years old. We were very close in the stages of setting up an interview with Fidel Castro through one of his sons. Well, that obviously is not going to happen now, but what an incredible story. Here is a man who outlived 10 U.S. presidents and went through some of the most tumultuous times I can ever imagine, escaping assassination by our CIA number of times. Fidel Castro, of course, died over the weekend at the age of 90. His brother Raul took over about 10 years ago, and we'll have to see what happens. Raul's up in age, too. Nearly 3 weeks after the election, Hillary Clinton's campaign said that it will participate in a recount process in Wisconsin, incited by the third-party candidate Jill Stein, and would join any potential recounts in two other closely contested states, Pennsylvania and Michigan. Michigan today certified its election with those electoral votes going to Donald Trump. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, are these recounts a little late and far, and nothing's going to happen, right?
Highly unlikely. The head of the registrar for the state of Wisconsin came out today publicly and stated there were no irregularities of any kind. Jill Stein's allegations of some kind of Russian hacking or hacking from some other nefarious group is completely bogus. And George, the real story here about this is the fact that Hillary Clinton in the last debate accused Trump of being anti-American, anti-democratic, anti-constitutional by not vowing to, concede, the election without looking at the results. And here we are now almost 3 weeks out from the election. And guess who's financing this? Now, Jill Stein is the front person here.
I would guess George Soros, maybe?
Well, no, I mean, yes. I mean, it's one of Hillary's many donors that she has that are ponying up the money. Remember that Jill Stein's campaign was virtually, she was destitute and in debt, and that's why prompted Trump to basically say that this is kind of a scam so she can just raise money to get out of some debt. But the real issue here is that there's nothing there for them to continue these recounts. They have to be done by the 19th when the Electoral College, 19th of December, when the Electoral College certifies the results. But if this isn't, sour grapes and Jill Stein proving that she is such a scoundrel to be doing this, when there's no basis, basically, for any differences that are going to... I mean, here are these poor people in North Dakota with that Dakota Access, these Native Americans, 200 tribes meeting. I mean, and they're about ready to flush these people out right now, 45 miles from Bismarck. And wouldn't the $5 million be more beneficial to go to these Native Americans that are fighting for their water rights, not to a stupid recount that will amount to nothing?
Sure would. All right. Thanks, John. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Crooks are out to ensure a blue Christmas for cyber shoppers using an array of online treachery and phone deals that are phony that will take in an estimated $1 billion this year, according to the FBI. Please be careful when you shop online. Sales and traffic, though, at U.S. brick-and-mortar stores on Thanksgiving Day and Black Friday declined from last year as stores offered massive discounts well beyond the weekend and more customers shopped online. Not a good sign for the bricks-and-mortar stores. Michael Mishedlock, investment advisor, not good. They were expecting a booming fourth quarter here, and Black Friday didn't happen, Michael.
Sure didn't, George. But, you know, we had a record spent online, $5.27 billion. More and more people are staying home shopping. You know, this is what we said right before. But we also cautioned, you know, that we really won't know these numbers until much later. We're getting a lot of these reports from the National Retail Federation. They always try and spin things in a positive way. I'm looking at reports here, and that's what they're saying. But average amount that people are buying down. People like sales. That's up. But what are these brick and mortar stores going to do, George? They're increasingly losing business online because that's where people like to shop.
Well, and I got to tell you, you know, if you don't need something today, wait a couple days, you get it delivered right to your door, you don't have to park, you don't any hassles fighting crowds. There's a big difference there, Mish.
Absolutely. My gosh, Amazon Prime, what, 99 cents or buck a year or something? Whatever it is, $10. You know, all the packages shipped you want for an entire year for one incredibly low fee. I mean, you know, we're Amazon Prime members here. We go online, we buy something, you know, you don't even have to be conscious anymore. You can say, oh, you know, I want this. You go get it. Free shipping.
And it's there. You got it. Mish, thank you so much. As you know, we have been highlighting over the past several months, and we'll continue to do so, incredible broadcasters who are podcasting. They're podcasting, and not a lot of people know that they're there. And so we decided we're going to let the world know what they do because they're dedicated people. They care about you. They care about what they do. And so a couple times a month, we feature podcasts. And tonight we're featuring the podcast of the Dave Hynes Show. Now, Dave is a longtime rock radio personality. He's a voiceover artist. He's a musician, Army veteran. Listen to his show.
More dangerous than a liberal with a cause or a conservative with a belief. The man who takes his half right out of the middle. The Dave Hynes Show on America's Talk on iHeartRadio.
Oh, goodness, my friends. It has been a rough week for the middle, has it not? Tough to be in the middle. He's got people on both sides telling you that if you're in the middle, you're wrong. The one group that has not had much of a defense in anything and maybe even been vilified are the people who didn't choose a side in the presidential election or maybe didn't choose one of the major sides. Where do you go from there? And you'd be part of the middle. Now that the election's happened, by the way, I don't want to make this whole show about politics. The show's never really about politics, but I didn't want to say I never want to talk about it because this is really more about life. This is about how you're going to deal with the people that you're around, the people that you love. I think the biggest problem is, how do you move on with your life? Because no matter what, the next 4 years are happening. I'm not saying that I know what's going to go on. I definitely don't. But I do know this. I'm still going to be here unless the good Lord decides to call me home or someone decides to hit me with a bus or something like that. I'm going to be here. I'm going to live through whatever happens. So what kind of team are you building for that?
Let's hope the good Lord doesn't hit you with a bus, David Hynes. Great stuff. David?
Oh, yes.
Good job. How long have you been doing this?
You know, I started doing radio in maybe 1998, but I've been doing the podcast here for almost a year now.
And you're having fun, I can tell.
Absolutely.
I was a guest on your show.
As a matter of fact, yes, I would encourage everyone to go check that out because you actually talked about some things that I guess you told some stories that I had never heard before and maybe no one else has.
Mm-hmm. I know you somehow got that out of me. Hey, but I think this is great talking to folks who have been doing podcasts, who are trying to get the word out about what they do And you and so many other people who podcast, David, need to get that exposure, and I'm glad we're able to help you.
Well, I can't thank you enough. And I love stories. I love people talking about their process and what their life is like. And so that's really the kind of guests that you're going to find on there, just things that make some new friends, really.
And when people want to hear you, how do they find you?
It's real easy. If you've got the iHeartRadio app on your phone, you can just search The Dave Hynes Show there. We're also available on iTunes and Spreaker. And just a quick Google search of Dave Hynes, H-I-N-E-S, and you'll find us.
All right, David, enjoy yourself. Have a great Christmas when the time comes, okay?
Thank you so much. You too, George.
David Hynes, great podcaster. And listen to this incredible story. There are multiple timelines playing out in parallel universes, according to a team of researchers. This sensational claim was made by a team of physicists who believe that the parallel universes can affect one another. This is amazing. Professor Howard Wiseman and Dr. Michael Hall from the Griffith University Center of Quantum Dynamics claim that the idea of parallel universes is more than just science fiction. Folks, we're talking real time travel as well. I love this story. And up next, of course, Robert Zubrin joins us as we talk about his work, The Case for Mars, Exploring Mars, and so many others. Next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast for the next couple hours. We're going to be talking with our friend Robert Zubrin, president of the Pioneer Astronautics and the Mars Society, as well as a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. Now, Robert has studied and researched the fields of aerospace and energy. He has been a guest on Coast to Coast for longer than I can remember. Here he is back on the program, Robert Zubrin. Great time to have you, Robert. Hope all is well.
Everything's fine. Thanks for having me back.
So, have they found people to go to Mars yet?
Well, there's no end to the number of people who would like to go to Mars. If you put it out for volunteers, they'd be lined up coast to coast.
I like that analogy.
All right. But the question is creating the systems to get them there. We have to have a commitment to do it.
Lots of interest in Mars lately, Robert. Not only with the Chinese, of course, and others, but Hollywood, too. I mean, director Ron Howard, who used to play Opie a long time ago, he has got a docudrama series out on National Geographic called Mars. Have you had a chance to look at anything on that?
Yeah. In fact, I have a bit part in it. The show, it's a very interesting, and it's a novel format. It takes place in two times. One is 2016, today, in which they have interviews from people who are active in the field, Elon Musk, Peter Diamandis, myself, Neil deGrasse Tyson, others. But then also it goes to 2033, where the story unfolds as to how these envisions might be actually realized. And so that is fiction. But I wouldn't call it science fiction. I'd call it more of an adventure story based on reality. And so you have this drama going on in the future in which some of these ideas that people are throwing around today are put to the test.
Is it pretty realistic?
Yeah, I would say so. There's no elements of fantasy in it, that's for sure. You know, there are things in it that someone could say, well, I would design that differently. That probably wouldn't be designed that way. But I haven't seen anything yet that is simply false.
We have been, of course, talking over the years about terraforming Mars to get it to the point where we could develop an atmosphere there and really do some incredible things. Has that grown any legs yet?
Well, only in the sense that it's now become increasingly clear that Mars did have a warm and wet climate and a thick atmosphere for a long period of time in its early history. So that, you know, you see water erosion features all over the surface of Mars, and it's now pretty clear that these were not transitory flows that only lasted a few weeks. These lasted hundreds of millions of years. So Mars had an ocean, it had rivers, it had lakes. it had liquid water on it for a longer period of time, about five times as long as it took life to appear on Earth after there was liquid water here. So I think the chances of finding life on Mars are high. Certainly the chances of finding remnants of life on Mars are high. But we'll come back to that. That depends upon a hypothesis that the laws that of science that led to the development of life as it occurred on Earth would hold elsewhere. I believe that is true. That's a question of belief, but
I think you're right. I think the chemistry and the physics for this is the same throughout the universe as long as you get the right mix.
That's right. So that's a fundamental hypothesis, and basically, I think it's a question of believing in science, that there are such things as laws of the universe, and that if they're followed here, they're followed there. In which case, the idea of life on Mars would not be surprising at all, given that it had appropriate physical and chemical conditions. And I think that by sending human explorers to Mars, we'll be able to find it. If there's life on Mars today, the place where it is to be found is in underground water. There's no liquid water on the surface of Mars right now. It's too cold. It's frozen. But if you go underground, even a few hundred meters, there should be liquid water. We can reach it with drills and bring it up. And that's where the remnants of Martian life, which would be microbial life, could probably be found. And then we'd be able to see if life as it develops elsewhere takes the same path as life did here, or whether it could take radically different paths.
Robert, what do you think happened to Mars? And can it happen here?
Not the exact same thing. Let's take the first part first. What happened with Mars is that, it was warm because it had a thick carbon dioxide atmosphere. You know, the greenhouse effect that everybody talks about, worried about for Earth, well, it's what Mars needs. It needs a greenhouse effect because it's farther away from the sun. And it had it. And so you had water and you had rain, and when rain comes down through carbon dioxide, it soaks some of it up, it takes it into solution, and then it takes it into the ground, and then that slightly carbonated water reacts with rocks and it forms carbonate rocks. Now that happens on Earth, but the Earth has this thing called plate tectonics, where the geology is constantly churned down from the surface into the underground, where it's very hot, and these carbonate rocks are destroyed, and the carbon dioxide is released again. It's a cycle. It takes hundreds of millions of years, but it happens. But Mars is only about half the diameter of the Earth, and because it is smaller, the plate tectonics just doesn't work on Mars. And so once the carbonates formed, they just got stuck. And so the atmosphere thinned out. And as it thinned out, the place got cold. And as it got cold, you start getting a new process, which is that the CO2 in the atmosphere just starts soaking into the soil from the cold. And once that happens, it accelerates. You get a runaway icebox effect, and the whole planet freezes up. And that's what happened. But that carbon dioxide that was just soaked into the soil, that could be driven out again. It's not chemically bound to anything. And in fact, we even see that happen a little bit every year, every Martian year. Mars is in this eccentric orbit where part of it is closer to the sun than the other part. And when it gets closer to the sun, its atmosphere actually thickens by 30%. If you can imagine that, that's like the Earth's atmosphere increasing by 5 pounds in pressure in the winter instead of the summer. It's crazy, okay? But it happens on Mars. Well, if we went to Mars and we set up factories to produce artificial greenhouse gases, designer greenhouse gases that are thousands of times more powerful molecule for molecule as greenhousing agents than carbon dioxide is, we could start warming the planet, and as we warmed it, CO2 would be driven out of the soil, it would add to the effect, and we'd get a runaway greenhouse effect, which is exactly what Mars needs. Okay? Mars needs global warming. We know how to do it.
Now, in this particular case, with what's been happening on Mars then, what happened a long, long time ago, and comparing it to planet Earth and other planets, we seem to be at a juggernaut in terms of people talking about the possibility that Mars had some kind of life. They're looking at fossils. Who knows what could have been out there? How extreme do you think life might have been, Robert?
What do you mean extreme?
In terms of beyond microorganisms, for example. And hold on, we're going to hit a break, so think about that. We'll come back and get that. Robert Zubrin, our special guest. We're talking about Mars for the next hour and a half here on Coast to Coast AM. So stick with us. We'll be right back. And, of course, because we're on so late night, we have breaking stories that occur throughout the night, and I want you to be one of the first to hear them. This story breaking from the country of Colombia. A plane carrying 72 passengers, 9 crew members involved in some kind of an accident. They're not specifying what has happened to the plane, but they are transporting wounded to the hospital immediately. So that's the latest on that situation there. And welcome back to Coast. I should add, we'll take calls with Robert Zubrin next hour. Robert, how many books do you have out now?
About 8.
Good for you. Good for you. And they're all just good, hard science books, energy books. Just how did you get involved in all of this? I bet when you were a youngster you loved
this. Well, if you want to know, it was Sputnik.
Really?
Yeah.
1957, right?
That's right. I was 5 in 1957 and when Sputnik flew, and I was already reading science fiction. And while to the adult world Sputnik may have been terrifying, to me it was just great, because what it meant was all these stories I was reading about the spacefaring future were going to be true, were going to be real, and I wanted to be part of that. So I got into it all the way. You know, started building rockets. My father bought me a telescope, you know, and this. And, you know, I was into all that. I was 9 when Kennedy made his speech committing us to go to the moon. And, you know, when I was a teenager, well, you know, we were going to the moon. We landed on the moon. I was 17. And, you know, we were going to be on the moon by 1970, Mars by 1980, Saturn by 1990, Alpha Centauri by the year 2000. We were moving out. I wanted to be part of it. And, you know, we accomplished the first part of that program, but not any of the rest. And, you know, while I was in college in the early 70s, the whole program was in the process of being collapsed. The Nixon administration was basically scrapping the fleet at the same time they were welcoming the astronauts back from the moon. And for a while, that set me back, and I became a science teacher because I wanted to do something, but, you know, we weren't going to space. But then, as it were, you know, in the 80s, I heard the bugle call, as it were, and went back to graduate school, became an engineer, and got involved in the space program.
Well, you know, Sputnik was the size of a basketball, and I just remember adults, because I was a youngster then too, just panicking, you know, say the Soviets have put a satellite up in space, they put a spacecraft up in space. They were going crazy. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. And I remember going out into the street and looking up, and you could see it, you know. And I mean, the thing I remember even more than the first Sputnik is the second, because that had the dog in it, Laika.
That's right.
And I remember there was a picture of Laika in the Weekly Reader, which was the children's newspaper they gave out at the schools. And I just looked at that picture of Laika.
You speak up, Robert. Speak up.
No, I just remember looking at that picture of Laika and just thinking about that. And, of course, I mean, Laika died on reentry, but they didn't emphasize that to us children. But but nevertheless, there it was. This was happening. And, you know, and Gagarin flew, and, you know, Shepard flew, and John Glenn flew, and, you know, and this was, and you know, during the 60s, every month or two, there'd be some new breakthrough in space, you know, where you launch people to 3 orbits around the world, 17 orbits around the world, 4 days in space, 2 people at a time, spacewalks, and then the 3-person capsule, and then around the moon, and then on the moon, you know? And I got to tell you, though, the strangest thing, in 1969, when we landed on the moon, I was in Leningrad. Because I was a young chess expert, and I was over there in Russia.
Oh, yeah, I got to play a game with you one day, whenever we meet up.
And all the Russians I knew, you know, just came to me, you know, they'd punch you on the shoulder, say, Molodets, like, attaboy. And you know, we went to the moon to astound the world with what free people can do. And they got the message, and they got the message in a positive way. It was like, yeah, that's the team we want to be on. And the Russians are enormously proud of their own accomplishments in space, fantastically proud of their own accomplishments in space. You have to understand that. But they viewed this accomplishment as like, okay, here's these Americans excelling at a sport that we respect. Okay?
Yep.
You know, and so there wasn't ill will in it. And you know, I think right now, you know, if Trump wants to make America great again, great nations do great things. And it's time once again to astound the world with what free people can do. So what we ought to do is commit to sending humans to Mars by the end of the second term, because we could do it. We could do it.
Oh, there's no question about it. And are we, I'm going to get into the Mars question about life, but are we moving in rapidly into privatization?
Not rapidly, but at a nice pace, I'd say. That now it's finally really happening. That is what you have. I mean, in particular with the SpaceX, Elon Musk. You know, there's been a lot of people talking about private space ventures since forever, but most of it's been just talk. Well, this isn't just talk. This guy, he has shown that he can develop space hardware at one-tenth the cost and one-third the time that has become accepted in the space business in recent decades. And not only that, develop things that people just didn't never try before, like rockets whose first stage, instead of just crashing, come back and lands right at the pad so it can be used again, which, of course, is the key to making space flight affordable. Because if we threw away airliners each time you used one, you wouldn't be able to fly.
No, no way.
A few hundred dollars. It cost $1 million to take an airplane flight. And there's that. And now we have Jeff Bezos, another one of these billionaires. He started his own rocket company, Blue Origin, and they're talking about developing a heavy lift vehicle of their own, which will also have a reusable first stage. In other words, Elon Musk has taken something that 2 years ago was considered science fiction, and now it's the standard, that the first stage will be reusable. Okay? And then once we get the second stage reusable, and then we're going to have cheap space flight.
We're going to get there, too.
Yeah. So, you know, so now not only, okay, well, he has this first stage reusable on a medium lift vehicle, the Falcon 9. He's going to introduce the Falcon Heavy next year, which will have about five times the lift capability of the Falcon 9. It'll be able to lift around 50 tons to Earth orbit. And with a capability of that size, you can start designing Mars missions.
So let's talk about what kind of life do you think Mars had at its heyday?
Well, okay, the conservative hypothesis would be just bacteria. Okay, now that would be interesting in and of itself. Okay, just microbes. Because we could learn a lot. I mean, it would show that the development of life from chemistry is the rule wherever you have the right conditions. And it would also let us know whether the kind of life we see in RNA and DNA and all these stuff, that the way life is on Earth, is that the pattern, or could it be something totally different? Okay, but could it have gone farther than that? Well, here's the thing. Life on Earth started to speed up its evolution as soon as there was oxygen in the atmosphere. The original Earth had no oxygen in its atmosphere. Oxygen was put in Earth's atmosphere by photosynthetic microorganisms, okay, green microbes, okay? They put the oxygen there. And as the oxygen accumulated, life picked up its pace. It picked up its pace of action, and it picked up its pace of evolution. Well, one theory is that precisely because Mars has no plate tectonics that recycles its carbon dioxide, and also because it's smaller, that it could have gotten oxygenated faster, in which case Mars life, which had about 1 billion years to run before the planet froze up, might have gotten a lot farther in that first 1 billion years than life on Earth got. In other words, if you think Mars life only evolved at the same pace as Earth life, then it wouldn't have gotten much past bacteria. But if it was able to accelerate itself because of oxygen, then it could have even gotten to macroscopic, you know, organisms, things that you could see that could crawl around and stuff like that. That's a hypothesis that's been put forward by one scientist named Chris McKay. We'll see. There's some very interesting stuff. The observations that Spirit, one of the two Mars rovers, made, the one that we landed in 2004, of some stuff that re-examining the images looked like it could be deposits left by colonies of microorganisms. That's right on the surface. And, you know, so we got to go. If we don't go, we won't know.
One of the big questions, of course, Robert, is the propulsion system. How close are we to getting something so dramatic, so fast, that it would change space travel for us?
Well, you see, I don't believe we need something that's much faster. Not for Mars. For the stars, yes.
The stars.
Not for Mars. For Mars, we can get to Mars right now in 6 months. 6 months is how long it used to take to sail from England to Australia. 6 months is the standard rotation on a space station. And so while today we're used to getting, you know, halfway around the world in a day or less, in the old days, people used to take trips that took 3, 4, 6 months, okay, or even a year to get to where you were going. And so people can do that. So for exploring Mars, for even colonizing Mars, the kind of propulsion we have now is good enough. Now, if we're talking about going to the stars, though, we need something better. To me, the strongest candidate on the horizon is fusion propulsion, thermonuclear fusion.
And how would that work?
Well, the fusion is the reaction that powers the sun and all the stars. It works by fusing isotopes of hydrogen together to form helium. And when they come together, they release a huge amount of energy. This is what powers the universe. And And now it is also our most powerful weapon. The hydrogen bomb is a fusion bomb. It has a fission trigger, but then the actual major explosion is a fusion explosion. Well, we have to make a controlled fusion reaction, and there's two ways to do it. One is with miniature bombs, and that's called inertial fusion. You just, like, imagine tiny H-bombs, each the size of a pea, but would have each have the power of, you know, like a large chemical bomb, okay, pushing the thing along, firing these, like a machine gun, firing these little peas, each of which would have the power of a ton of explosives. And that would push the thing along. That's one way to do it. That means you have to be able to do fusion explosions without the fission trigger, but there are people who think they know how to do that.
Without blowing up the spacecraft, for crying out loud.
Yeah, well, true, but that would only happen in the reaction chamber. The other is magnetic fusion, and this is also a kind of fusion that people talk about for making fusion reactors for power on Earth, where you have this, the hydrogen is in diffuse form, and it's reacting plasma, and it just reacts like a flame a little bit at a time, but releasing a great amount of energy as it does it, and you would contain it with magnetic fields. This is a very tricky thing to do. People have built experimental fusion reactors to try to do this, and they work for a little while, but the magnetic fields, they buckle, and the plasma escapes, and you have to put another plasma in and heat it up, and so you use a lot of energy doing this. And they've got these to the point where they produce about as much energy as you takes to run it, so it's not yet a practical form of energy. But in fact, just today there was a news story on the internet that they've developed a deeper understanding of how these magnetic fields work, and they may be able to control these instabilities and have stable magnetic confinement of plasmas, in which case what we're talking about is not just a space drive that could get us to the stars, but an unlimited source of power on Earth. There, in a gallon of seawater, there's enough hydrogen that if used in fusion, it would produce as much energy as 350 gallons of gasoline.
That's it? That's amazing.
Yeah. In what? 1 gallon of water, there's as much energy, if you could release the fusion potential, as 350 gallons of gasoline.
Well, that ought to keep us going for a while, huh?
Yeah, so that would put an end to all this talk about limited resources. Because if you've got the energy, you can do anything.
What about anti-gravity?
That one, well, that's actually interesting in a way, because, you know, 20 years ago, that would just be science fiction, period, full stop.
Not anymore.
no such thing. But, well, these astronomers discovered that, you know, the universe not only is expanding, but the expansion is accelerating, which means that there is such a thing as an anti-gravitational force. Because if there was just gravity, then the universe could be expanding, but it would the expansion would be slowing down. Like when you throw a ball up, first it's fast, and then it slows down, and eventually it stops and falls back to you. If you threw it up hard enough, it would slow down, but it would never stop completely, and it would escape the Earth. That would be a rocket, okay? But it's still, it's fastest when you first throw it. But imagine a ball that when you throw it up, it speeds up and up, okay, with an anti-gravitational force. That's what the universe is like. Now, we don't have a clue as to how to create that force, but there is such a force.
I'm concerned, too, Robert, that space is becoming more weaponized. I just had a story that I read over the weekend that, you know, China wants to use space more for, you know, warfare than anything else. Is that a concern of yours?
Well, yes and no. Well, let me put it this way. Control of space is going to be the decisive theater for any future conventional conflict between major powers. All right? Let me illustrate. Okay, that is, if you say that, look, it's not going to be a nuclear war because everybody knows that if you use a nuclear weapon, you also get nuked, and so forget it. Okay? So you're going to have to do your fighting with conventional tanks, planes, ships, and all of that. All right?
Right.
But, so imagine, so you have, now you're talking, though, about a war not with Panama or something or Iraq, but with Russia or China, with a country that really has some stuff, all right? And it's a real question as to who's going to win on the ground. Now, so like World War II. Imagine if in World War II, the Axis powers, the enemy, had reconnaissance satellites, just one of our current space capabilities. Then, say, take the Battle of Midway, you know, where the aircraft carriers of Japan and the U.S. fought it out.
Yep.
The Japs, they would have had reconnaissance satellites. They would have seen where our carriers were long before we knew where theirs were. They would have launched an airstrike, they would have sunk our carriers, and then the remaining surface ships all would have been sunk by their airplanes. We never even would have seen their ships. Okay, it would have been all over. You know, in the Atlantic, the U-boats would have had a field day sinking the Allied convoys. On the Russian steppe, the German planes would have found the Russian tank columns before they ever made it to the battlefield and taken them out. All right, so with that one capability of current space, if the Axis powers had reconnaissance satellites and the Allies not, they would have won the war. Okay? Now, so if a power can have a monopoly on reconnaissance satellites, it can win any conventional warfare against some other power where it has comparable forces. Now, if you add to that GPS satellites, which don't just tell you where you are, they can be used to guide munitions to make them 1,000 times more accurate than unguided munitions. So now your artillery, one artillery piece, can score 1,000 times more hits than an enemy artillery piece that doesn't have the advantage of GPS guidance, all right, or, you know, anything like this. So it's clear that if one side could clear out the other side's satellites, it will have an overwhelming advantage in conventional conflict. And, for example...
Hold on for a second, Robert. We're already at the top of the hour, but we'll come right back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.